So, good afternoon. Actually, I'm going to cover some of the same territory that Mary Angela was covering in the last question, but maybe that's just good. The last lecture I gave was a kind of hard, in the sense that I spent most of it doing a long calculation. So this lecture is going to be a little more soft, in the sense that what I'd like to do is now kind of get some of the results of that and try and see what that has to do with what people actually see at, oh, this is what people actually see at the LHC. So I would claim that at a qualitative level at least, QCD explains the whole range of phenomena that we see at LHC. Later, as we go into this, we'll see that QCD explains many of these phenomena at a quantitative level and even at a level of rather high precision. But first of all, just qualitatively, LHC physics has pieces of it which are non-perturbative, pieces of it which are perturbative, pieces of it which are electroweak perturbative, which are small, and hopefully we're going to find out pieces that have to do with new physics beyond the standard model. LHC physics is very complicated because it covers an enormous range of cross-sections and phenomena. So if I ask just, what's the total probability for something to happen when I collide two protons at LHC energies? The answer is about 100 millibarns. So a unit of cross-section that's more or less the size of the proton itself. If I ask what's the probability for PP to go to some new particles, where these new particles would be things that appear in theories like supersymmetry that we might want to test, the answer is probably 10 femtobarns. There's a wide range of predictions here, but that's the order of magnitude. And the difference between this and this is 14 orders of magnitude. Okay. So, in order to understand how to do this, you have to understand everything that goes on between here and here. And so I thought it might be interesting to give you a lecture that basically goes through all the various stages and, where appropriate, relates that to what we've talked about in terms of QCD and electroweak in the earlier lectures of this series. So, first of all, something that has nothing to do with perturbative physics, but which is very important, which is the total cross-section. Maybe before that, there are going to be a lot of slides in this lecture. I did include here the detector designs for ATLAS and CMS. There's Itai, if you do that, you're going to be running up and down because they're. Okay.
You can see all the small
Yeah. I guess Pierre Savard is going to tell you a lot next week about the design of ATLAS and how one does physics with ATLAS. But I think it is important, of course, experimenters work with this, but even for theorists, to understand what all the major components are and their capabilities. And if that's something that you need a refresher on, probably we should do that offline. The ATLAS and CMS detectors, CMS is on the next slide, are somewhat different, but they both have the characteristic that they're enormous. This thing here is the human scale. I once heard someone give a talk about ATLAS where they say, we ask those people to get off when we turn on the accelerator. CMS is about half as large, so here's the human scale for CMS. And it has somewhat different strategies for tracking. Both of these detectors are designed with high-energy muons in mind, and because those are the particles that you can definitely identify out of the mess of hadron-hadron collisions. And it's interesting to talk about that, but that's not really the subject of this lecture. In any event, it's from this, we're going to get event pictures very similar to the ones that I showed you for SLD. there are tracking components, then electromagnetic calorimeters, then hadron calorimeters. B tagging is going to come in. And that all comes in at various levels of the analysis of these events. So what I'd like to do now is start from the, I told you it wasn't worth your time to turn the lights on. Let's start from the top level. So probably the interesting number there is the inelastic cross-section. Sigma for PP going to an inelastic collision. This is a measured number at 8 TeV. It's about 75 millibarns. 75 millibarns is pi r squared for r about 1.5 Fermi. So this is really the proton as a bag of quarks and gluons hitting another bag of quarks and gluons with probability one liberating quarks and gluons. And there's a certain event structure that goes along with this, which I guess we have to start talking about in order to understand the deeper levels. Here, by the way, are the measurements of the total cross-section and the inelastic cross-section. The total cross-section is rather subtle to measure. Either you have to go very far upstream, or you have to use indirect measurements based on these numbers to get the numbers for the elastic cross-section. By the way, the numbers above LHC come from cosmic ray experiments. And as you see, it's really not so easy to make accurate measurements of the proton-proton collision unless you're at an accelerator. So let's now talk a little about the event structure of this. This is a purely non-perturbative process. So what you can imagine, there are two ways to model this. And roughly, both of them come out to have the same qualitative predictions, the details all buried in the parameters of the model. One is, as I say, two Lorentz-contracted bags of quarks and gluons that can hit each other, split open, and spray particles with various momenta. The other, which we'll talk a little more about later, the fact that low momentum quarks and gluons, mainly gluons, can interact with gluons through low momentum interactions, causing low momentum scattering processes that then lead to jets and producing colored particles that can interact with other particles in the initial state. The main characteristic of these reactions is that because any high momentum transfer process is a perturbative QCD process that's suppressed by powers of alpha s, the particle production here is all going to be at low transverse momentum. And so typical transverse momenta of less than a GeV here, whereas the particles that are coming in have hundreds of GeV or TeV energies. And so these particles are distributed in a certain way over phase space. And that's something that's interesting to talk about. So one thing that you might say, especially in the model where you have two gluons interacting, is that the two reacting particles have a very wide range of energy, and the products have a very wide range of energy. A way of expressing that is in terms of the rapidity variable that we talked about in the lecture before the last. So let me write down again a representation of a general vector, Lorentz vector of a particle. So we can put in front of this a quantity that I'll call MT, the transverse mass, cosh y PT over MT, and sinh y, where the transverse mass is the pt squared plus the actual mass of the particle. Y is a quantity that under Lorentz transformations just shifts. And so it's a very convenient variable to use because I don't know what frame this glue-glue collision took place in, but if it took place in a different frame, that would just be a shift of y. And to the extent that those interactions cover a very wide range of frames, I can think of this as a process which is roughly constant in this parameter rapidity. Now, most of the particles that are produced are pions. So this is hundreds of MeV or maybe a GeV. The pion mass is small compared to that. And so it's a good approximation to then approximate this formula with the mass of the particle equal to zero. If we do that, we get a representation of this massless vector that looks like this. P mu is the PT. Cosh, let's call this new variable eta, 1, and the cinch of eta. And eta is called the pseudo-rapidity. Now, pseudo-rapidity is very convenient because it's a very good approximation to the rapidity if the PT is much larger than the mass. But on the other hand, it's directly related to angles. So we can actually measure it directly in the detector without identifying the particle. In particular, the relation is that e to the eta is equal to the sum of these two things, namely p plus p3, or p parallel to the beam, divided by pt. So this is 1 plus cosine theta in the detector divided by sine theta. And another way to write this formula is 1 plus cosine theta over 1 minus cosine theta to the 1 half. So in general, particle production, the low momentum particle production, oh, and then finally, let's just take the logarithm. Eta is equal to 1 half the logarithm of 1 plus cosine theta over 1 minus cosine theta. So in a very rough picture, particle production from these low momentum transfer interactions is going to be distributed uniformly in rapidity. And when we move from one frame to another, we step in rapidity, or for light particles, pseudo-rapidity. The transformation from theta to rapidity is something that actually is kind of important to understand when you do hadron physics. So let me just make you a little table of this. Eta of 0, of course, is 90 degrees in the detector frame. Eta of 1 is already, oh my god, I need my glasses for this. Eta of 1 is already 40.4 degrees. Eta of 2, 15 degrees. Eta of 3, 6.7 degrees. So now we're getting closer and closer to the beam line. Eta of 4 is 2.1 degrees, and eta of 5 is a fraction of 1 degree. So if you want to cover a large range in rapidity, it's easy to cover from here to here, and it's progressively harder as you go to higher and higher rapidity. Now, the whole rapidity range of LHC runs from something like 9.5 to minus 9.5. So an elastically scattered forward proton would be out here somewhere. And what's important is that for obvious practical reasons, the distance in rapidity that you can actually cover with an experiment is more like from minus 4 to 4. So those whole big devices that I just showed you are covering really only the central range in terms of how the particle production is spread out. It's very easy to produce, just by disrupting the proton, high-energy fragments that end up here or here. And so this is kind of the first fact of life about LHC physics. You can't measure the whole event, except in some exceptional circumstances. You can only measure what's going on in the central region. Yes?
Where did the number 9.5 come from?
Oh, this is just plugging the proton mass and the proton energy into that formula. Okay. Okay, now, if we think about, and maybe I should also just show you, it's on the previous slide, here are measurements of, in just generic events, the PT of particles. So as you see, look at how many orders of magnitude there are here. It really falls off enormously by 1, 2, 3, 4 orders of magnitude by the time you get out to 3 GeV. Also, please notice that there's a significant energy dependence. So this is the initial LHC running at 0.9, and this is at 7 TeV. And that energy dependence signals that the particles out in this region actually come from a different origin than the generic particle production. So all of this non-perturbative stuff is confined to more or less this region here with what looks like an exponential fall off over many orders of magnitude. And then out at large PT, we're going to have some different physics that fills that in. Okay, if we have this notion of rapidity, we now have a notion of a way to visualize the event, which is very important. Namely, let me write the rapidity axis. Now remember, there's stuff out here and there's stuff out here, but what we're looking at is roughly between 4 and minus 4. And let me put on this coordinate the azimuthal angle. So roughly what I'm doing is taking the detector, I'm representing phi, theta by rapidity. Phi is the azimuthal angle, so I'm going to take this cylinder and unfold it into a plane like that. And the prediction of the kind of models that I was talking about here is a uniform scatter of particles in this representation. It's uniform to the extent that the distribution of frames in which the gluon-gluon collisions are occurring or in which the particles are coming out of the bags is uniform with respect to boosts. Of course, it's azimuthally uniform. That's just a simple symmetry. And now, this is the first background that we find to any kind of particle production that comes from a perturbative or other origin. The rule of thumb is that you have one charged particle per unit area on this phi versus rapidity plot. And so that's always something that's going to be there just because the protons disrupt each other, however hard the reaction is that you find on top of that. Now, and let's see, I have one more slide that I should show you here. So here are some actual measured distributions of particle production versus rapidity. And as you see, the level of the plateau is quite flat. This is from 2.5 to minus 2.5 to 2.5, which is the region where you have charged particle tracking in ATLAS and CMS. And as you see, it's not perfectly flat, but it's, to a quite good approximation, flat over this interior region. Okay, so now maybe one can have an idea for how to look at reactions. And this is a way to represent what a particular event looks like, which is actually very useful. And we'll see it as we continue through this talk. So let me imagine that I have now a reaction, an LHC reaction that takes place. So what we've decided already is that the QCD prediction for what happens at large transverse momentum will be typically quark anti-quark or quark quark or glue glue collisions given by perturbative QCD. And In the kind of representation that I was discussing before, we take a parton out of the proton. We have those guys scatter by an elementary QCD reaction. We produce two partons, which, if there's a large momentum transfer here, end up at large transverse momentum. And then by the mechanism that I discussed at the end of the last lecture, each of them will make a jet. So I'll end up with a two-jet event. So then you end up with events that look like this. Two jets, more or less back-to-back in PT at this level of approximation, surrounded by an enormous number of high-momentum tracks, which are basically at small PT, I've written here the momentum vectors, but of course the trajectories don't look like that. So a very nice way of representing this is something called the Lego plot, where what I'd like to do is to take my detector, which is around here. The detector you might think of as a calorimeter. Maybe one can be a little more sophisticated. So it has pixels which pixelate this plane. In each cell of the plane, some energy is deposited. And in particular, in each cell, some PT of I is deposited. And now what we'd like to do is to just plot on that plane in eta and phi the PT in each cell as a tower. And this already is a way of getting us from the non-perturbative region to the perturbative region. And it's just fun to look at a couple event pictures. These are actually from the Tevatron, from D0. Here's an event display of a typical event in D0. You can see that there are about 40 tracks there. It's a very large number of charged particles that you see. However, if you look at that event on the Lego plot, it looks like this. It's, as you see, a scattering of single particles. The scale here is 10 GeV. So there's hardly anything that's even at a few GeV of transverse momentum. Here's another event which looks almost exactly like the first one, at least certainly more or less exactly like the first one if you ignore the red and blue things. But on the Lego plot, this event looks like this. Well, this is now a quark anti-quark scattering event. What you see here is an enormous amount of transverse momentum deposition into this collection of pixels, and then back-to-back, so a distance of pi in the phi variable, another equally large tower. So back-to-back QQ bar jets that are scattering from one another. Very often when you see event displays from LHC, they suppress all the low momentum tracks. But that's the art of the experimenter, to try and visualize only, quote, what's important. OK, now, this gets us down quite a bit in rate. Because if I, first of all, just throw away all events that look like this on the Lego plot, I can win, as you saw, orders of magnitude in rate. If I look at only events like this, however, I still have an overwhelming rate. And if in general, we're going to have to throw away many events like that, except at the highest PT, in order to get into the regions of LHC physics that we really want to explore. Earlier, when I discussed quark-quark scattering, I showed you this plot. It's inaccurate in various ways. Please don't take the numbers completely literally. It's 14 TeV, but it's with, for those of you who know what that is, no K factor, no next to leading order corrections. So it's kind of systematically a factor of two low. It is not a differential cross-section. It's a cross-section integrated out to infinite PT. And what it does is to give you an idea of the various rates that you have for various kinds of PT two-jet events. And, what do you see here? If
so sigma 1,000 is the cross section for 1,000 PT.
So this is a 1 nanobarn from, it'll be here on out to infinite PT. Okay. And then with the nominal luminosity, which I think I actually took as 10 to the 33 when I wrote this, so the real situation is a factor of 10 larger, there would be one a day of, let's say, greater than 1 TeV jets, one an hour of, well, this is already greater than 1 TeV, one a second of, well, it would now be up here somewhere, jets with PT of 400, and 100 a second of jets with PT of about 100. And 100 a second is about, or 200 a second is about the rate at which you can possibly write things to tape and have enough computer time to analyze your events. So unless there are other special characteristics of the events, more or less everything under here is something that you just don't have time to look at as these proton-proton collisions take place and as the events rush toward you. The actual event rate at the LHC is one event per 40 microseconds. So, that's not right. One event there is 50 nanoseconds, and they're going to go to 25 nanosecond spacing. So actually, if you were to continue this curve up and up, you'd find that at about 10 GeV, you have one quark-antiquark or glue-glue mainly collision for every LHC bunch crossing. And at that point, basically, you have an idea that this picture of low-energy glue-glue collisions begins to fill in the whole particle production at LHC. In fact, I believe it is true that every LHC collision event contains a 5 to 10 GeV jet. And so below that, it's almost not worth counting jets because there's just too much QCD that's happening. So either to understand physics, we have to go out to very large PT, or we have to look for more special signatures, more special kinds of events that we're going to see. Okay. Now, we put all of this behind us. We go out to large PT. We suppress the low energy tracks. And now we have typical events that look like this. So here in this plot, they've only plotted the relatively high PT tracks. And then you can begin to see in the event displays a two-jet structure of the kind that we were seeing in E plus E minus. Here's the corresponding LEGO plot. So you can see there are two back-to-back jets, neatly balanced in PT. And now we're in a situation where we kind of understand how QCD works in this case. Now we have to go into the next level of complication. OK, well, you can look at event pictures like this, and you can find the jets by eye. I think the next one, yeah, here's a nice picture. This is another kind of typical event from ATLAS. Can you see this? Maybe we have to ask Itai to go turn off the lights again. So how many jets are there in this event? Two jets or three jets? In the LEGO plot, you see two jets, but they're obviously not balanced in transverse momentum. And the jet finder found another jet over here, relatively small transverse momentum. So, but the question of whether you call this a two-jet or a three-jet event actually is ambiguous in a very interesting sense. And so that's the next thing we have to talk about. To discuss that, I'd like to go back a little to E plus E minus. Can we have the lights on now?
Now done.
I see. It's now done automatically. Okay. So let's go back to E plus E minus and talk about this question. In E plus E minus, we have, for example, the reaction E plus E minus to QQ bar. And as I've explained, samples of tens of millions of these events were produced at the LEP collider, and they were studied with great care back in the 1990s. Essentially, we have an electron and a positron coming in. They annihilate to a virtual photon or of Z or maybe a real Z. They produce a quark and an antiquark. The quark and antiquark go off and start radiating gluons, which then split to other gluons, radiate more gluons. Eventually, you get a more or less collinear shower of particles. Of course, these particles are not exactly collinear. And at some times, you can have one radiated at large angle. And the distribution in PT, you remember, is dpt squared over pt squared. So actually, the distribution of each successive gluon is logarithmic in PT up until you get to the point where it's somehow spoiling the kinematics of the things that are inside it in the Feynman diagram. Well, the strength of this is controlled by alpha s. And alpha s is a quantity that runs. It is small for very large momentum transfer and large for small momentum transfer. But you can see that if alpha s were constant, and this is a logarithmic integral, the whole process would be scale invariant. And if there were no confinement and alpha s were constant, which frankly is a good approximation over a large dynamic range for when you start with 100 GeV or 1 TeV quarks, then this process of gluon radiation and particle-subparticle formation is a scale-invariant process. So what we're talking with about here are fractals. And in order to define what the pieces are of a fractal, you need some convention. And so whenever we're going to then go back and ask to count jets in an LHC event, we're going to need a convention which is going to define how many jets there are. So this was done in a certain way in E plus E minus. And let's talk about that first. The original definition came from actually an even earlier experiment called JADE, and there's something called the JADE algorithm, which is the following. So we have some S, which is the center of mass energy squared. We have eventually, this turns into some particles that come out. And the particles have momenta pi. We define yij is equal to 2 pi plus pj, sorry, pi plus pj squared divided by s. So this is roughly the mass of the two-particle system divided by S. For a Z event, we might easily have a jet whose mass is 10 GeV, two jets back-to-back coming out of a Z decay at 90 GeV. So now how do we define a jet? Well, we can define a jet by taking the final particles and clustering them according to some algorithm. And so what the JADE people proposed was the following. We have some collection of particle momenta. We compute the yij. We then pick the smallest one. We then ask, is that yij minimum less than some value called y cut? And if the answer is yes, you stop. And if the answer is no, then you combine pi plus pj is equal to some new momentum. You put that back into here, and you continue this process. So eventually, what we've done is to cluster all the particles in the event into combinations whose y is less than, wrong inequality, whose in such a way that if we were to combine two more particles, we would get a cluster with mass sufficiently large that it would, that its y would be greater than y cut. And so we're putting together all the particles that have small mass combinations, and then gradually lowering that threshold, gradually putting together more and more particles, and eventually we'll end up with some clusters with a maximum mass defined by this thing equal to y cut. So in that way, you can have, now y cut is a totally arbitrary number, but in that way you at least have a convention for, and then, please excuse me, and then if we stop, we identify the jets as the final momenta that come out of this process. So wherever we stop, that's a conventional definition of the number of jets. If y cut is large, most of the time we'll combine everything into two back-to-back momentum vectors and we'll end up with two jets. If y cut is small, we'll have lots of little clusters and we'll have lots of jets. And the evolution from large y to small y will just be a mirror of this process of QCD radiation. And in fact, we should be able to predict that from QCD. So I'd like to show you this plot, which was produced by Aleph, which was one of the experiments at LEP. And it's really quite an interesting plot. So I'm sorry, it's kind of cut off at the bottom. But at the bottom, it should read log 10 of y cut. So y cut of minus 2 here is y cut equals 10 to the minus 2. So this is about a 10 GeV jet mass as the cutoff for an experiment done at 90 GeV. And what you see is exactly what I said. So here's the data. And as you go to smaller values of y cut, so you refine your jets, you have a lower and lower maximum jet mass, you find more and more jets. And this guy peeking up here is 6 or more jets in the event. When y cut is large, when your description of jets is very coarse, you dominantly have two jets. Then when you make it more open, what you see is a third jet, a fourth jet, etc. The solid curves are the predictions of QCD Monte Carlo programs. So you can also model this process by taking the evolution equations that I derived this morning and just using those emission rates in a Monte Carlo generator. You generate gluons and quarks according to the splitting functions that we derived this morning. And when you do that, you actually predict the rates at which the 3, 4, or 5 jet events appear. So you see the three programs, Pythia, Herwig, and Ariadne, being compared there. These three programs actually all have different hadronization algorithms in them. Although, I must say, in all three cases, the hadronization algorithms are tuned to data. But at least the underlying physics of those algorithms is completely different. Nevertheless, they have the same QCD model in them. And so they capture this physics, as you see in all three cases, in a very nice way. OK. Well, this is a kind of idealized way of doing jet counting, which takes into account, as I said, the fractal nature of jets. It has a problem, though, for hadron physics, because as I've emphasized to you already, in hadron physics, you don't capture the whole event. And so you have to have a different algorithm, which is more local in rapidity, that doesn't require that you find everything in the high rapidity regions in order to do a complete mass calculation. And so typically what's done for jet counting at the LHC is you look at things that are local on the eta phi plane. And so let's go back to this eta phi plane, and we'll have essentially particles, or we'll have calorimetric clusters that are measured at various places on that plane. Now we can define a distance on that plane. Delta Rij is equal to eta I minus eta j plus phi I minus phi j. So this is literally the distance between two of these identified clusters that are found in the detector. And now we can define some jet distance measure in the following way. Dij is equal to the minimum of Pt of cluster I to the 2 alpha, Pt of cluster j to the 2 alpha, times the delta Rij divided by R squared. And R here will be an arbitrary parameter, which is plays a similar role to the parameter y cut over here. And maybe I should say there's also a distance from the beam, which will be simply PTI to the 2 alpha. So now, using this distance measure, we can play the same game as we did over here with the Jade algorithm. You take the clusters that are closest together in this distance. You associate them. Unless you're associating it with the beam, then you define that to be a jet. And so gradually, what will happen is you put together events that are in some way near each other in the A to phi plane, according to this algorithm. Eventually, everything gets clustered with the beam, and those are the final jets in the reaction. And again, you get a jet definition which is arbitrary because it contains this parameter R, but it is at least definite, so you can then have a computer algorithm that classifies the jets in each event. The values of alpha here have some names, and maybe it's worth talking a little about what's actually done with them. The kind of obvious thing to do is to choose alpha equals 0. That is, just literally associate those clusters that are closest together on the R phi plane. And this is called the Cambridge-Aachen algorithm. So there, essentially, we're going to put clusters together until they are separated by a distance which is about R. It's slightly subtle because when you put two momenta together, you move the position, and that can have an effect on whether you're going to cluster that with a neighboring algorithm. Another thing that people proposed was to choose alpha equals 1. So this is the so-called KT algorithm. And this is somehow very close to the Jade algorithm. Now, maybe we should ask the question, what should be the properties of an algorithm that will do this clustering in an effective way? And that's something that I probably should have discussed in the E plus E minus case, but maybe it's not too late to discuss it now. To do that, we probably should step back and ask what would happen if, instead of trying to cluster the final particles after hadronization — I mean, after hadronization, everything is at least well-defined and finite — we could try to go to the QCD side and cluster particles that result from a QCD evolution. And the thing that I ask you to remember is that in QCD evolution, when everything is massless, whenever two particles become collinear, or one of the particles becomes soft, you have an infinity in the cross-section. And to get a finite prediction for the probability that there are a certain number of jets, or for the rate of, let's say, n jets with definite PT, you had better try and get finite answers for that. And so the thing you have to insist on is that your JET algorithm, when you go to the singular limits, is well behaved. That is, if I have a gluon, or I consider the case of a gluon splitting to two extremely collinear gluons, whether this happens or not can't affect the JET rate. Also, if I have a gluon and I radiate an extremely soft gluon from it, whether this interaction, which happens with infinite probability in QCD, whether it happens or not cannot affect the JET rate. So such a JET algorithm is called soft and collinear safe. And if you want to be able to predict the number of jets or the distribution of jets, the PT of jets, in any event that involves QCD, either E plus E minus or hadron colliders, you had better choose an algorithm which is soft and collinear safe. Actually, all of these algorithms that I've discussed have that property. It's obvious for Jade because this is always a zero mass object. And so if this interaction occurs, it'll be the first one to be clustered. Similarly, if you have a soft particle, this combination has zero mass, and this will be the first one to be clustered there. Over here, it's maybe slightly less obvious, but also true, that two collinear particles appear at the same point in the A to phi space, and so they're naturally clustered together. And a particle which is emitted soft may appear over here, but please excuse me, is eventually sucked into the nearest particle without influencing the JET counting. In fact, there's another.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about this algorithm? So when you said that you calculate delta R of J.
Yes.
But as you're calculating and putting them together, doesn't the value of the Rij change?
Yes. Actually, historically, there's a subtlety in this, what I called here Cambridge Aachen. There's a variant of it, which you can imagine to be the following. You look over your calorimeter, you find the hottest spot, and then you combine that first with whatever is nearby. And that algorithm, it turns out, is not soft and collinear safe. I'd have to work a little to try and demonstrate why. I think it's basically you can have a soft particle which is halfway between two hard particles. And it becomes ambiguous when you cluster this one. It then the momentum moves slightly in such a way that so whether this particle is closer to that one or closer to that one when it's soft affects how the clustering occurs. If you have an unbiased or seedless algorithm, it actually is safe. And this is something that in early days people worried about. Actually, interestingly, the algorithm which is most widely used for general purposes at LHC is neither of these. Kachari, Salam, and Soyer realized that you could actually choose alpha equals minus 1. And this goes under the name of the anti-KT algorithm. And they showed that this algorithm is actually soft and collinear safe. And anti-KT is an interesting thing. It is dominated by the softest particles. And it causes the softest particles to be sucked up by whatever is close to them. And in practice, it forms an extremely nice circular jet, better than a cone jet in Cambridge, Aachen. So there's actually a very beautiful set of lecture notes, which I recommend to you if you want to learn more about this stuff, by Gavin Salam. Here's the archive number. It's also in the notes. And what's done here is to compare, for the same event, the jets that you get with these different algorithms. And I'm sorry, could you turn on the lights just a little so we can see this? OK. So this is KT, Cambridge, Aachen. This is another kind of cone algorithm, and this is anti-KT. This is the same event, just clustered with different algorithms. So what you see is that the very high PT jets all come out the same, but this is the area in the A to phi plane which is sucked up into the jet. And it's actually different in each case. But if you were to consistently apply the same algorithm to theory and experiment, that is, use the same clustering algorithm on the particles or calorimeter hits that you do on the QCD calculation that tries to predict the d sigma d jet PT, then you could make a consistent calculation, although it would be different for each particular jet algorithm. It's also different depending on the value of R. And very oddly, Atlas and CMS couldn't agree on this. So Atlas typically uses R of 0.4, and CMS usually uses R of 0.5. Actually, 0.4 and 0.6 and 0.5 and 0.7 were the initial choices. So just to frustrate anyone who wants to compare these experiments. But when we talk about jets and I show you Atlas data, I'm typically looking at counting jets using the algorithm, which is the R equals 0.4 anti-KT jet algorithm. OK. Maybe now let's talk a little about what happens when you count jets and try to predict the number of jets. So I think the next slide, is actually a comparison done by Atlas with the data shown as the yellow steps and the various, again, Monte Carlo generators. Yes?
How do you compare how good an algorithm is to the other one? Like, how do you say that anti-KT is better than KT by this much? Like, is there like a discriminator?
Well,
or is it just by eye, by looking at the cones?
It actually depends on the purpose. So if you're doing particle searches that depend on the number of jets, you might want the jets to be very regular, because so then it's easy to calibrate them. And that this odd choice of anti-KT happens to, you see visually, have a big advantage for that. If you want to do very precise QCD calculations for some purpose, you might want a jet algorithm that looks a lot more like the mass of the jet. And for that purpose, people like the KT algorithm, even though it collects particles from much more of a phase space. And it's not really true that one jet algorithm fits all possible analyses. I think anti-KT is kind of magic, though. It is safe in the sense that I was trying to explain here. It produces very regular cones, and so it's much easier to think about than the other algorithms.
Are you going to get harder jets in a KT algorithm, or they'll all be about the same energy in the end of the day?
They'll all be about the same energy, but I don't know. Can you help me here?
Total question. You mean on average, do you see more? I mean,
on average, are jet PTs higher if you use KT?
No, that's not true.
Like, yeah. I thought that maybe like small jets just wouldn't count in, so I thought if you're using more broad algorithms, then maybe you'd be having harder jets because there would be extra jets in your event, but they wouldn't pass a PT cut in the end of the day. So possibly you'd have harder jets than KT for the end.
No, that doesn't happen. It's really on the theory side that some theorists think that the QCD estimates are better controlled if you use a jet definition that's more related to jet mass. I guess I can't evaluate that. When David Kossauer will discuss this. You can ask him the same question. Yes?
What's with the directionality? Maybe one of the algorithms matches the direction of the jet that you find.
Well, okay. Yeah. The answer is, again, it's somewhat unclear. Okay. So now I've told you how to define a jet. So now we can go count jets. So, one less jet. See you later. So we have a QCD event. It produces two jets, but because of this radiation, we might interpret what it produces as 2, 3, 4, maybe more jets. If we have gluons radiated at large angle, that's a contribution proportional to alpha S of Q, which produces definitely an extra jet outside the cone. We can then also try to calculate the rate by doing a QCD computation to a certain level of perturbation theory. At the leading order, you produce two jets. At the next order, a third jet. At the next order, a fourth jet, some of the time, depending on your jet definition. If you have a Monte Carlo program, such as I've described before, which basically does, in principle, infinite number of gluon emissions, you can produce a very large number of jets. And so what this slide shows is a comparison of such Monte Carlo programs. This is, I think, already at the just to the leading order in QCD plus all orders of logarithms when you sum up these jet emissions versus the jet multiplicity. And what's interesting is the regular decrease on a log scale when you add a jet. So this is actually a very characteristic property of LHC physics. Maybe I should bring this down and write here. Yes?
Should we be concerned by the rescaling of the theory?
Well, this is a somewhat large rescaling. But remember, this is leading order. So there are large corrections to the normalization. The leading order, as you see, has errors of order 40%. And next to leading order calculation, probably I should have put that comparison here, would have corrections of the order of 15 to 20%. Next to leading order, nobody's been strong enough yet. So people will get there eventually. Good. So this is something very characteristic of LHC physics. However you define your jets, if you talk about events with 0, 1, 2, 3 jets, and you put over here the log of the cross-section, you find a regular decrease of the cross-section with the number of jets. On this particular analysis, it's a step of, please excuse me, about a factor of 10, as you see, for each jet. So this is something like alpha S over pi, maybe a color factor of 3, as you would have for gluons. And so in some sense, however many jets you want, you just wait long enough or accumulate enough events that you can measure that cross-section. And I think on the next slide, I just ought to show you an event from ATLAS, which is interpreted as a 6-jet event. This is actually in the first year of LHC running this was taken. So it's not hard by the standards of event accumulation at LHC to produce very complicated events that come only from the kind of QCD processes that we've been discussing. Quark-quark scattering accompanied by gluon radiation from all the sources. OK. Okay, so now, yes.
What JetPT cuts are they applying to get these sort of plots?
Let's.
Or is it independent of that value?
No, it's not independent of that value. The lower the PT cut, the more jets. But I think the canonical for Atlas is 20 GeV. 20 GeV, PT greater than 20 GeV, R equals 0.4 anti-KT jets. And it doesn't say on this slide, but I assume that that's the definition which is used here.
But is the factor of 10 independent of the PT?
Oh, no, no, no. No, if you had a harder PT cut, this would get smaller. Okay, remember that what accompanies this is some logarithm of the Q over the PT. So as you raise the PT cut, that logarithm gets smaller, and this ratio gets smaller. Okay, good. So now what we have to do, if we want to actually, for example, look for new physics at LHC, we have to think about what are things that we can look for in the events, and hopefully even use to select events that are not related to just the complexity of the event in terms of the number of jets. We could try to look for events with many jets, but if we do that, we'll just find them from QCD, independently of what else is going on in the event. So there are various things that you can try to look for. The first one is missing ET. We can look for leptons. We can look for bottom quarks. So there's a list of things that you can make, and then you can try and combine these in various ways. Missing ET is something that's very interesting for reasons that Mariangela just discussed. If you have dark matter production by one of the routes that she just described at the LHC, that will produce invisible particles, which are then not observed by your detector. What you'll see instead is a momentum imbalance, where you have some jets which go off in some direction. And in this direction, there must be an unobserved particle that goes off, but that's something that you can't see. However, as I've already emphasized to you, the momentum is always unbalanced in the longitudinal direction because you don't cover the whole event. So the only chance you have to measure this thing is to project everything onto transverse momentum. That's the reason that there's a T here. You're looking for the imbalance of the transverse momentum, which you would measure in an event, assuming that the things that go very forward carry very small transverse momentum. Now, hopefully, Pierre Savard will tell you about the measurement of ET. Before the LHC ran, this was considered to be an enormous challenge. I think it's easy even for theorists to understand that the easiest way to measure missing ET is if your detector works on this side and it doesn't work on that side. And so enormous effort has gone in both in Atlas and CMS into controlling this problem. So basically finding hot cells in the calorimeter and turning them off, correcting for dead cells. A really remarkable performance is achieved, and it's shown on this slide. So if the missing ET response is only basically the counting statistics, you expect to see a dependence which is the square root of the sum of the ET. And in fact, here's the data. It's I think the fit is to 0.45 times the square root of ET being your missing ET resolution. And that's comparable to your overall calorimetric resolution. It's really extremely impressive how good a job these people have done. And this is now the technique that enables analyses, for example, where you look for supersymmetry by looking for jets and then neutralinos or something like that that are escaping. Of course, as was pointed out, the important background is if you produce a Z0, a Z0 decays to nu bar 20% of the time. And so there's always going to be some background where you produce jets in association with the Z0, and the Z0 decays in some way in which it's invisible. I should turn to leptons next, but probably the next thing I should do is show you this slide. So now we've talked about the measurement of these various event classes. Up and down. Excuse me. And so this is a graph produced actually for the recent US snowmass study, which just illustrates the range of cross-sections predicted by QCD at the LHC. So again, this is in nanobarns, so 100 millibarns is that line at the top. That's the total cross-section. Please notice how high is the line for the total BB bar production. That's at the level of microbarns. And so it's again, many orders of magnitude above the processes that people would think are interesting either for standard model tests or for new physics. Just looking for bottom quarks in an event, it's just kind of hopeless to be able to find anything other than just two gluons colliding and turning into a pair of bottom quarks. And so, for example, one of the very important processes that we'll discuss tomorrow for Higgs production is glue to Higgs to BB bar. And the BB bar is supposed to have the mass of the Higgs, which is 125 GeV. And if you compare this to glue to BB bar, just a set of BB bar jets with that mass, the rate of this process is about a million times the rate of this process. So one needs a better strategy. However, very often you can combine bottom quark signals with other things like missing energy or leptons to try and root out interesting physics. The next things we see as we go down here, so this is the jet cross-section for jets greater than 50 GeV. And as you see, even that is at a level orders of magnitude above the more interesting processes. W and Z are the Drell-Yan cross-sections. We'll talk about those a little more in just a moment. This is direct gamma production for a gamma greater than 50 GeV. And then down here at the nanobarn to picobarn level are top quark production, multi-W processes, et cetera. So once again, I'd just like to make the point, in order to study things that are down here in the range where we have heavy standard model particles, or hopefully new particles that we might want to discover, it's necessary to somehow have control over all of these reactions that are occurring at much higher rates, but which are, if you like, just ordinary QCD processes. Okay, now I guess the next thing is to talk about Drell-Yan. So the Drell-Yan process we've already discussed. I drew it before as a reaction where proton and antiproton emit a quark and an antiquark, which then annihilate into a W boson or a Z boson. So this thing can then decay leptonically. And direct leptons are things that are not, in general, produced by QCD reactions. So these are very characteristic signatures. It is important to realize that on the way in, we're going to have collinear jet production. So these things might actually be interpreted, especially if they're at wide angle, as additional jets in the event. So I think don't turn off the lights for this. The slide is pretty clear, but here's the status of it. These are measured values of the Drell-Yan production cross-sections. These from the Tevatron and these from LHC, compared to the kind of best theory calculation, which is, by the way, next to next to leading order. And you see the agreement is really quite good and tracks the energy dependence extremely well. If you ask how many jets there are in the... Oh, and here's an event. This is a CMS W2 electron candidate. No high momentum tracks. An electron and the arrow indicates the direction estimated for the missing transverse energy. Actually, if you insist that it is a W, you can solve for the longitudinal momentum with, I think, a twofold ambiguity. Now, this is a very interesting plot if you think about particle searches. So this is the collection of W to mu nu plus jets event. So once again, PT greater than 20 GeV, R equals 0.4 anti-KT jets, the number of jets, and the Monte Carlo prediction. Please excuse me that I, I'm sorry. This is probably out to that number, the black hat, the next to leading order prediction. And then a composite of what processes are contained in these events from the running of Monte Carlo and trying to compare the event rates to theory. So you see the overall agreement with the rates is quite good. The process is dominated by W plus jets production. That's the white. But there are, in fact, significant contaminations. The green region here is actually TT bar production, where you have a W, there's got to be another W in the event that, for example, you've missed the lepton because it went forward. And in general, again, you see this kind of staircase-like pattern where there's some factor of order 0.1, which gives the rate for finding one more jet as you go down the ladder. So if you're interested in mu plus missing energy plus jets as a supersymmetry signal, then the events out here are going to provide some kind of background to that. And as I say, this whole pattern is generated just by the kind of physics we were talking about here. Here's the analogous result for z to mu plus mu minus plus jets. So again, dominated by the Drell-Yen process. Actually, this process, if you like, directly measures a jets plus missing energy process if you replace the mu plus mu minus by neutrinos. And once again, please note a significant top quark contamination, which has also got to be accounted as part of your background. Okay. I think probably the next thing to discuss is top quark events. I'm going to discuss the properties of top quark decays in the next lecture. But I'd just like to show you that, you know, now we're down in the below one nanobarn region of cross-section, but still well above a femtobarn. The top quark cross-section at, at 8 TeV, where this is measured, is about, as you see, 250 or something like that picobarns. I think at 13 TeV it goes up to something like 800 picobarns. And once again, these processes are going to be backgrounds to supersymmetry searches that are at the 100 or even 10 femtobarn level. Here, the total cross-section for top quark production is given. And it's compared to QCD predictions. Actually, I think this slide doesn't incorporate the most recent theoretical calculations, which are now done to next to leading order. Although, the error, however, still gets a significant contribution from the errors in parton distributions, in particular, our lack of knowledge of the gluon distribution. And one of the ideas is that if indeed the theoretical calculation can be defined, and if you assume that there's no new physics in this reaction, you can actually use a precise measurement in comparison with theory to discard some parton distributions in favor of others and refine our knowledge of the gluon distribution. Something that I always find totally amazing about this plot is this point is the Tevatron at 2 TeV cross-section, which is about 7 or 8 picobarns. And by going up a step, which is only a step of 3.5 or 4, we're already in the cross-section range of hundreds of picobarns. So this has a very straightforward explanation in terms of QCD, but I think I won't explain it to you, but I ask you to think about that and see if you can figure out what it is. As you see, it's the prediction of QCD. So you should be able to think about theory and explain that. But I think it's quite non-trivial how big the step is. It's an even bigger step when you realize this is PP and this is PP bar, which has a QQ bar annihilation channel at a higher energy. So think about that. In any case, it really works spectacularly well. And there's one more class of events that I should probably point to here. Which is that it's also possible to have events where you produce a single top quark. An example of such an event is maybe the following, where I would take a proton and another proton. I take an up quark out of this, which turns into a down quark, exchanging a W. Out of this proton, I'll take a bottom quark, which secretly arose by gluon splitting, because at the LHC there's plenty of dynamic range for gluon splitting, and this can turn in now into a single top quark produced in the event. Actually, single top can occur in both the so-called T channel and also in the S channel, where you have UD bar going to TB. And this T-channel process has been observed at very high significance. The S-channel process, I think, is observed at some moderate significance now. And here is the T-channel cross-section compared to a QCD prediction. Again, it works extremely well. Okay. This, I think, ends the kind of litany of LHC cross-sections that I wanted to describe to you. So once again, the general idea of this lecture. I described this morning the process of collinear and almost collinear QCD emissions, which first of all leads to the evolution of structure functions in the initial state, and secondly, in the final state, leads to jet formation. The jets are, as I explained already, fractal objects, so you need some convention to define a jet in such a way that as you make a more refined definition, you find more jets. QCD is successful, by the way, in describing that evolution. And then, using these tools and the basic parton-parton reactions, you can go through and describe the whole range of reactions that you see at the LHC, from hard quark-quark scattering, which is at the microbarn level, to bottom quark production at the several microbarn level, eventually Drell-Yan production, which is at the nanobarn level, top quark production, which is at the hundreds of picobarn level, keep going down. Eventually, with enough luminosity, maybe there's some new physics there. But in order to demonstrate that, you have to understand the backgrounds that come from all these various levels that are on top of it. And that's really the big challenge of doing LHC physics. Okay, that's good for today. And tomorrow we'll talk about the Higgs boson. Okay, questions, please.
That has bothered me for actually a little while now. Why is the T channel more dominant than the S channel process in single top production?
Oh, because the W, this is a W again. So here you need to have a center of mass energy, which is at the W mass.
Mm-hmm.
But here you don't.
Oh, I see.
Okay. It's an odd thing, but it's something that is interesting to realize. If you have a particle M and M prime, it's relatively easy, if these are both relativistic, to promote M a large distance in mass. And so this particle actually doesn't have to be very far off shell to do that. And it's relativistic kinematics.
I see.
So if you think of this as highly boosted, its momentum is already almost aligned with a highly boosted but massive particle with the same longitudinal momentum. And so a relatively low Q squared will do that. And so here, the W doesn't have to be very space-like. Here, it has to be as time-like as the W. Actually, more time-like, because it has to produce the top quark. Okay. Other questions? Yes? Up there.
Often I hear of tagging jets, detagging jets.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Oh, so I showed you an example in the first lecture of where people use displaced vertices in order to tag a jet as a B jet. So let's see. I think I didn't put that picture in this slide, but let me show you one that I actually took out of this lecture and I was going to show you tomorrow. No, that's not what I should show you. So you remember in the first lecture, I showed you this event, which is now on the macro scale, the four stories high detector scale. And I told you that you can put silicon wafers in a little box about that big, very near the intersection region, and visualize this picture for the tracks. And now you see that there's some tracks that are coming from a primary vertex, and other tracks that are displaced by a fraction of a centimeter. And so this is the C tau of half a millimeter for the bottom quark times a gamma factor. The higher the boost, the further it goes away, but it's always going to be centimeter scale. So in LHC, you get to about 4 centimeters away from the interaction region, and people put specialized silicon detectors there. And then you can image the tracks, which are, as you see, millimeters with vertices millimeters away from the actual beam spot. And so if you see such a thing, that will, of course, with some background, tag the event as containing a bottom quark. Now, in some cases, a jet might contain 2 bottom quarks. For example, if you have a glue, a splitting the BB bar within the jet. And so that's also something that you can try to apply a tag for. That's somewhat more difficult. Charm tagging is also something that you might imagine. That charm, you have to do roughly a factor of 5 better in your resolution of the secondary vertex from the primary vertex. And that's considered to be kind of on the edge, somewhat marginal at LHC. Is that what you were asking? Okay. If you ask me afterward, I have some Hadron Collider pictures with similar displaced vertices in them that I can show you, but they're not in these slides. Yes?
How does the MSN LS can detect some particles that will be produced in pseudo rapidities equal to zero? I mean, for tunnel.
Sorry?
I mean, imagine that in the LRC, we atom, proton and proton collision.
Yes.
And our cylindrical CMS and Atlas can cover the all phase space, I think, instead of pseudo rapidity is equal to zero. Because
pseudo rapidity of zero is the center.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're talking about large pseudo rapidity?
Zero is equal to 90 degrees.
Yes.
Yes. And in pseudo rapidity is equal to zero, it means some particles produced in the direction of proton proton.
No. It's the opposite. So pseudorapidity of zero means it's produced at 90 degrees.
Yeah.
So it has large transverse momentum, but zero longitudinal momentum. So it's going right into the calorimeter.
How about in 90?
Sorry?
Large pseudorapidity.
Okay. Now, large pseudorapidity, remember, 2 degrees here is a pseudorapidity of 4. So the track, the volume covered by tracking, I think I actually showed this slide. It's while the lights are out. Maybe I should show it again. Okay. So the numbers here, can you read them, are the pseudorapidities. And so what this shows is the tracking, this tracking chamber of Atlas, of, sorry, CMS. So you have silicon, which is essentially this way, and then you turn the silicon wafers around, and then these things are accessing down to below outside of 2.5. Typically, the good tracking will cut off at about 2.5, which is here. And then outside of that, you have only calorimetry. So there'll be some, there's a device where you can see it here, which lives in the forward region and does calorimetry. So it can find electron tracks, hadron tracks, photons that are emitted into that region. And that goes down to 4.5 or 5, so a fraction of a degree from the beam direction. Now, if you want to go forward of that, you need a more specialized detector. So at CMS, there's an experiment called TOTEM, which is located, I believe it's something like 100 meters downstream on each side. And basically, a proton which is scattered almost forward is deflected by the accelerator magnets themselves into that detector and measured. And in that way, you can measure the elastic scattering cross-section down to extremely small angles, and then use that to make an estimate of the elastic scattering cross-section and eventually the total cross-section. So basically something in this region, you need to do something very special in order to find the particles that are there. So for the purpose of proton-proton elastic scattering, there is such a device associated with CMS. Yes.
What kind of experiments actually use particles of eta greater than 3? I mean, I've never actually seen a search that's saying that we include jets greater than 3, eta equal to 3.
Well, that's because you can't measure them, right?
But you said that there is some kind of like detector there that you can still use.
So let me give you an example. We're going to talk tomorrow, actually in both lectures, about the process of WW fusion. So let me draw this Feynman diagram today. I'll discuss it in much more detail tomorrow. So let's imagine that I have my proton and my proton here. Let's pull an up quark out of this proton and have it radiate a W boson. Let's pull a down quark out of this proton and have it radiate a W minus boson. And then these things can come together, and it's pure electromagnetic production. And probably the first interesting thing that you can have is that there's a vertex that produces the Higgs boson. And then you have the Higgs boson, which can decay to various things. And you can try and study the Higgs boson in this mode. It's quite interesting, because if you ask what the Lego plot looks like for these events, it's very characteristic. There's no color flow from this proton to that proton. So all the products of this proton go very forward. So they're only in this region. All the products of this proton, the hard products, are going very forward. So they're only in this region. Actually, it's not really true, because the protons are bags. So they disrupt each other. So this region is spotted by this low momentum production that I talked about. But nevertheless, the two jets, let me use a different color for that, live somehow here and here. And then in the center, what you're looking for is some object characteristic of a Higgs boson. So for example, a 1-against-3 system that you might identify as a tau plus tau minus event. So tomorrow I'll show you an event display with, or in the afternoon tomorrow, I'll show you an event display with this topology. Now, how do you select such events? Well, what you want to do is to insist that these jets are very far apart from each other. So what's typically used is a delta eta between the two hard jets greater than 4. And so, yes, you can squeeze that into a tracking volume, but the further forward you can go, the more chance you have of having an efficient identification of these events. And so this is one region why you really need that forward region to be operating correctly, because one of these two hard jets will typically be in that region, and they're part of your signature for the Higgs boson. Okay? Mm-hmm. So tomorrow I'll tell you a lot about this process. Other questions? Yes?
I didn't quite understand why particles are propagating uniformly in rapidity. Could you explain that again?
Well, as I said, there are two different models that you can use. One is the model where just the bags are disrupted. And you could say in that case it's kind of the easiest assumption to make. You have some thermal distribution that has no preferred frame. It's just every particle is in some frame between the two proton momenta. For gluon-gluon collisions, maybe because you know what gluon distributions look like, you can make a better estimate. But for small x gluon distributions, fg of x is something like 1 over x. And if you convolve two distributions like that, you get something which is fairly flat in rapidity. So I think it's, at the time this was proposed, it was really just kind of the simplest assumption that people could make. And it works okay. As I showed you, it's not perfect. By the way, the idea of a kind of a hot thermal region uniform in rapidity has a name. It's called the Feynman-Wilson gas. And this is apparently the result of Richard Feynman and Ken Wilson trying to figure out in the 1960s what these high-energy proton experiments would look like when they came online. And I'm Wilson's student, so I'm fond of it, but it actually works okay. Oddly, characteristic of those guys, it circulated in preprint for 10 years before it was published. This is only zero temperature cavity. Well, the temperature also depends on the fed in this complete collision. This is only, well, if you want to model this as a hot gas, then you might bring in temperature. It's hot because the two bags, as they disrupt each other, the partons inside are somehow heated. It's not a very rigorous picture. This becomes more rigorous when you talk about nucleus-nucleus collisions. And there's a space-time picture of nucleus-nucleus collisions where the two nuclei, when they go through each other, heat up to a very high temperature. And then the thing expands transversely. And in that expansion, it cools down. And when it cools down to a temperature at which you can form pions, that is a temperature well below the deconfinement transition, then you hadronize. So that was worked out by Bjorkane in the early 1980s. And there's a very beautiful article by Bjorkane that describes the space-time evolution of a nucleus-nucleus collision in those terms. And this general kind of space-time picture works to interpret the data on nucleus-nucleus collisions from RIC and from LHC operating in its nuclear-nuclear collision mode. Here it's much more, if you like, hand waving. But it is actually true that, let's see, if I, so I showed you these graphs of the PT spectrum of individual particles. And here it's the log of the number. And I showed you that there's some kind of exponential decrease and then a long tail. And this exponential decrease is very well fit by something like the MT, which I defined, the transverse mass of the particle, divided by a characteristic temperature, which has a value of about 150 MeV. It's called the Hagedorn temperature. The tail comes from jet physics. So everything out here at high PT was somehow a part of a jet. But this is what I described as the non-perturbative particle production. It has this structure, and sometimes people like to think about it thermally. Yes?
When you're showing the various cross-section processes,
yes.
It seems as though BB bar with the dominant.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just curious why is BB bar so dominant over, say, like DD bar?
Sorry, over.
Why bottom quarks as opposed to down quarks?
Oh, down quarks are, you know, higher. I didn't even draw the down quarks. See, at more or less every event where it says total has a down quark scattering with let's say 5 GeV of PT.
Okay.
The B quark is the only one that's heavy enough that I can consider it a separate process. Okay. From the level of these questions, there must be many more questions. I've got plenty of time. What can I say? Yes.
If you look at this plot, then you like grossly extrapolate to, let's say, 10,000 PV.
Yeah.
It looks like the total is actually almost flat. So you would gain a ton if you went to huge through S. Is that somewhat of extrapolation? Like if you look at the slope of all the lines.
No. But you have to be careful. Each of these processes has a definite mass scale. And that mass scale, compared to the square root of S, is becoming smaller and smaller as I go this way. So if, on the other hand, so you see this line here, and it's really hard to read, where it says jet.
Mm-hmm.
And what it says is jet with PT greater than 50 GeV. And that's a line that looks like this. If, on the other hand, I said jet with PT greater than, what would the number be? 0.01 square root of S, that line would go like this. Okay, it's a log scale, but it decreases with, it's proportional to alpha S squared of the PT of the jet. So you win in terms of these processes, but if you had a 1,000 TeV collider, you might want to try and produce 1,000 TeV, or at least hundreds of TeV particles. And those would have enormously small cross sections. While all these cross sections would continue to rise. So the answer is life just gets harder and harder.
That's true beyond quantification.
You see, even at the LHC now, the top quark, which was just a minuscule effect at the Tevatron, you know, people. Maybe there's a total of 100,000 top quarks ever produced at the Tevatron. The top quark, if you look at LHC searches, is almost always the major background. And even in searches that are like leptons plus missing energy, it's often the major background. So why the top quark should be so annoying when it's such a heavy object, that just has to do with the fact that the top quark cross-section is rising because it's a fixed mass scale. As the energy of the mass of the things you're looking at is increasing. So those cross sections are going down. Okay. Once again, I remind you of the question that I asked here. Why are those numbers so large compared to this number? And someone should come with the answer before tomorrow.
By the way, there is another interesting thing about those cross sections, not this, the previous plot you had,
yeah.
The cross section that connects to what Mariangela was talking about. If you look at the cross section for Z plus something production, it's huge, right? And
yes.
If Z goes to, as Michael told us to memorize, Z goes 20% of the time invisible.
Right.
20% of that cross section is still a huge cross section.
Right. And now if you add a jet, it's only a factor of 10 decrease every time you add a jet. So you can add 4 jets, and you're still in a region where it competes with your new particle production.
So that is the major background for searches for dark matter at LHC.
There's a lot of physics in this plot, and it is in the notes, so you can go home and study it.
Go to the dorm and study.
Wherever you guys are going at night. You can go to the bar and study it over a couple of days. Any other questions I can answer? Anyone? Okay, I guess you're totally beat up today, but tomorrow morning, bright and early, Higgs boson physics.